In today's market, cash flow isn't created by hoping rents go up or waiting for cap rates to compress. It's created by operators who know how to force value, even when the market isn't doing them any favors. I'm Kevin Bupp, and this is the Real Estate Investing for Cashflow podcast, where we break down how cash flow in commercial real estate actually works, from underwriting to execution and everything in between. Today's guest is Andrew Keel, a repeat guest on the show and a hands-on mobile home park operator who's built his business around three things that many investors overlook: disciplined operations, infill inside supply-constrained assets, and buying in secondary markets where fundamentals matter more than hype. Andrew isn't chasing appreciation. He's manufacturing NOI. His approach offers lessons that apply far beyond mobile home parks. If you care about real cash flow, not just pro formas, this episode is about where value is actually created in today's environment. So let's get into it. Andrew, my friend, welcome back to the Real Estate Investing for Cashflow podcast. It's always great to catch up with you. It's always great to see you, and excited to have a fun conversation here today.
Oh, same here, Kevin. No, looking forward to catching up and talking shop about mobile home parks.
Yeah, yeah. So Andrew and I were just joking a little bit before we start recording here. Is that we were talking about golf, right? And I was joking how I'm still a crappy golfer, and even though I've been playing it for 20 years on and off, but you know, I grew up in Pennsylvania, and I grew up in a town where there wasn't much to do. And so I picked up golf and got pretty decent, played quite a bit, moved down to Florida at the age of 22, which was 20 plus years ago. You know, Florida is really the golf mecca of the U.S., and I don't really play all that much anymore. Well, I'm getting back into it. And whereas Andrew, on the flip side, grew up in Orlando, the golf mecca of the country, and didn't pick up golfing until he moved to North Carolina a year or two ago. So it's
weird how that worked out.
I know. But anyway, buddy, well, outside of golf conversation, excited to have you here. Excited to talk about, you know, the world of mobile home parks. And I know you've been at this now for, are you a decade plus at this point in time?
I'm a decade plus guy now. So I've joined the club.
No, it's exciting. And I remember many, many years back, and maybe we can dive into this later on the show, but I remember one of the things that really stuck out to me the first time I met you at probably, I don't know, one of the MHI or CECO events, you know, one of the industry events, is that you and your wife, I believe, in the very beginning, you guys literally used to buy communities and then go, you would move into them. You would literally move into a unit or a house if it was on site, and you would live there until you got the place stabilized, and then you would move on to the next. And I believe, correct me if I'm wrong, you actually had your first child while you were like kind of going through this rigmarole of living in various communities. Is that correct?
So we did have a 1-year-old. We had her not while we were living there, but we had her, and then we moved to Ohio and lived in a house in front of one of the first parks we bought, and love she it. Was with us. And yeah, I mean, looking back, it's like, geez, we were just a bunch of carnies, you know, just going from town to town and, you know, getting buying the next deal. But
yeah, where there's a will, there's a way, man. You got to make it happen. The thing is that 99% of people would not be willing to do that. You know what I mean? Everyone wants success, but the majority of folks, you know, when it came to brass tacks, hey, you got to go. The only way this is going to be successful is if you go spend 3 months there, 6 months there. Most folks wouldn't do it. They wouldn't get out of their comfort zone and go do it. So kudos to you for stepping out of the box and just making it happen. So you've always got these deals that perform versus those that might not hit the mark. What do you think that most investors most often misunderstand about, you know, where the cash flow is actually won or lost in a respective deal?
Two things, right? One is operations. Like, you really have to have your hand around the assets and understanding them. And particularly in mobile home parks, you know, I was buying deals that were rough, right? Had like 40 vacant homes and, you know, 30 vacant lots. And, you know, I'm going to spend time there, you know, filling all of those and getting them rehabbed and everything. So that's why I needed to be on site, you know, and being, you know, giving it more attention. But then I also think a lot in commercial real estate as a whole revolves around the debt that you put on the assets. Back in the day, I learned from guys like you and others that, you know, we believed in fixed rate debt, right? We weren't taking massive risks with variable rate or with these like bridge debt, you know, facilities. So I think that really helped get us through some of the tough times is having that fixed debt on these assets. Just, it helped us sleep good at night too.
You know, plenty of folks that have done big infills and they've lost their butts, right? Like it theoretically, it's pretty simple. You got vacant lots. You maybe didn't pay too much for those vacant lots. You're going to put new homes on them. You're going to have people waiting in line to move into them. You pretty much just back them in, park them. They're ready to roll, right? Like, it's pretty simple in theory, but like there's a lot more moving parts there. And so, you know, where do you think some of the misunderstanding lies as far as, you know, infill and, you know, why it works so well, or for some folks, it might not work?
infill, I think, is one of the hardest parts of the business. That, like, we have a few guys that's all they do is they work on infill, you know, and capital projects, as I'm sure you do as well. But I think one of the big things is when we're going in, you know, we don't pay a ton for those vacant lots. You know, I've seen other groups, like even in properties we've sold, where they were valuing the vacant lots at some, I don't know how they come up with a value for those, because the bank doesn't value them. But we basically don't pay going in for those vacant lots at all. So that helps. But then a lot of it is just the execution of finding the inventory, right? Used homes, I think, became kind of a niche of how we're able to source used homes. And honestly, in the very beginning, I created this whole Google Drive folder that I think I probably shared with you, Kevin. But like, I created this folder, and it was me like going across the country, taking videos of myself going through these homes, looking at everything, the ceilings, the floors, and basically developing a training module that I can show these guys that work for me now of, hey, this is what type of used home you want to buy. This is the type you don't want to buy. And then we do bring in some new inventory as well. There's a process, there's steps, and it's so important, you know, to just know ahead of time and to budget. I think a lot of guys also go in and they're like, okay, we're going to use the cash flow. We're going to use the cash flow to, you know, infill. And it's just a much longer process. When you have bulk too, you're able to say, hey, I'm going to hire you to come and transport these five homes into my park. You're going to get prioritized, right? Versus somebody that's, you know, bringing in one-off homes, you know, once every year. So that has helped us too with our vendors.
How do you make the determination of bringing a used home in versus that of a brand new? How do you guys make that determination?
Yeah, so it's market specific. You know, we started in the Midwest, right? Like buying in these secondary markets like Des Moines and Indianapolis and Fort Wayne and Sioux Falls and those type of markets. And in those markets where the median home price was well under $200,000, it just didn't make sense for us to buy brand new and bring them in, when we could get a used home, you know, infilled, set up and everything for $25,000, you know, all in. Also, you know, in HUD states, you know, when you have to put piers in the ground, concrete piers down, it's just way more expensive overall compared to used homes, where sometimes you can get away with ABS pads or other options based on, you know, how the building department looks at it. So it was just way less expensive. It is way inefficient because, like you're saying, we're having to like hodgepodge one-off, you know, homes. But you know, when our total basis into a lot is $25,000, and lot rent's $450, and the value of that occupied lot is $50,000, it's a big pop, you know, and it helps us get to that, you know, refi evaluation that we're looking for.
You mentioned you guys spend a lot of time in the secondary markets, and you have some smaller markets. What do you, when you're out there, you know, maybe use the example of a market recently you've looked at deals and where you might not currently own anything. You've been looking to maybe expand the footprint there, but don't currently own anything at the present time. What are you looking for that tells you that, you know, there's durable demand there? And, you know, even though there's not maybe a huge population, maybe it's not, you know, there's not a lot of job growth. I mean, but it's pretty stable market. It's got good underlying fundamentals, but like what are the data points that you're seeking to at least give you the green light to move forward?
Yeah, the biggest one would be median home price, right? Like median home price over 200,000 is just going to be a whole new demographic compared to, you know, some markets that in the beginning days, we were looking at median home price above 100,000. And when you can buy a house for 100,000, 105,000, you know, three bedrooms, two bath, you know, versus buying a mobile home that, you know, maybe is going to be like a brand new one, maybe 55, 60, you know, just the translation there is not going to correlate. So looking at median home price has been big for us. And we've developed too, you know, from the early days where we were, you know, buying in those more smaller tertiary markets, we've kind of, you know, grown up a little bit and have found some deals, you know, finally the mom and pops in Raleigh. We got two deals in Raleigh this past year. Finally, you know, after 3 to 4 years of calling these guys, they finally wanted to sell. And yeah, they're not like right in the metropolis, but they're, you know, 45 minutes outside. Again, the median home price is one of our biggest things we look at. And then we look at the two bedroom apartment rents in the area. And we try to look at the zip code specifically, because we feel like from one zip code to the next, there could be a big difference.
Yeah. So just just to summarize, your floor as far as median home prices today is 200K. And then what are you looking at as far as apartment rents? Like, what are you looking at for 2 and 3 bedroom apartments? Where do they need to be in order to get you excited?
Typically over $1,000 is what we're looking for. You know, that's kind of the floor price. And it's usually over that. You know, rents have gone up drastically, way, way faster in apartments than they have in MH. So that's usually the median home price is the one that we see is a more difficult metric to hit.
Would love to, you know, there's a lot of, you've been in this a long time. You've looked at a lot of deals. There's, I'm sure we both can share quite a bit of stories of deals we maybe were excited about, you know, got deeper in and then for one reason or another, you know, didn't move forward, either got under contract and found some things that were unsettling, or maybe didn't even make it to that point in time, right? Just like, you know, from outside looking in some initial due diligence, you realize that like it just wasn't going to be a good play. You know, is there anything that comes to mind, a recent deal maybe that you guys got excited about, maybe tied up? And then I think you guys are just like us. Like typically if we tie something, we're closing it. Like very few times have we ever killed a deal, but every once in a while skeletons pop out that you didn't anticipate. Is there something you could speak to? And if so, what were the skeletons and what were the reasons that you decided that they were, you know, insurmountable and that you just, it'd just be better off just to move on to the next deal?
Yeah. The one that sticks out to me is one we had in Michigan. It was a great looking park. I mean, utility infrastructure, everything was really well taken care of. The owner was really on it. But when we went to the property assessor, the first time over the phone, we kind of might have spoken to like a secretary or an admin and didn't really understand the assessment process as, you know, as well as we should have. And then once we got there in person and we met with the actual assessor and sat down and had a conversation and realized what the property taxes were going to be reassessed at, it was literally like 700% difference than what the current owner was paying. And so it was just an instant deal killer, you know, and you could spend a lot of time on a deal, but you have to be willing to walk away, you know, like that would have totally crushed any cash flow we would have had for at least 5 years, if not longer than that. And it was just this owner had owned the park for so long that he just hasn't kept up with the assessed values of other similar parks that had sold more recently. So that was a big deal. Utility infrastructure is a big one in mobile home parks. Like we, you know, we're getting pressure testing done on the water lines. We're, you know, talking to tenants and we are, you know, cameraing sewer lines and looking at lift stations. You know, there's always hair on the deal, right? Like I don't think I've bought in one park that didn't have some sort of hair on it, right? That had some weird quirk to it, or had a lift station we had to take care of, or had a septic field that, you know, had you know, a health department issue or something. So utility infrastructure, we spend a ton of time on and like really understand it, meet with the vendors of the seller, meet with independent, you know, vendors to make sure that we're cross-referencing and checking everything we can. And then another one that we canceled recently, this one had like these park models on them. It had like out of an 80 lot park, it had like 20 or 25 of these park models. And it's a whole different realm. Like the turnover, what we found out, we didn't find this out until we like flew up there and started talking to people, but the turnover on those park models was like once every 6 months, someone was in and out of that thing because they thought they wanted to live in a tiny home and then they lived in it and they're like, okay, this isn't actually what I want to live in. And so, you know, I think that's another big thing is like how a deal goes bad is these hidden capex, you know, from turnover that pops up that you didn't plan on, and it just can eat away your bottom line. So that's something we track really closely.
Yeah, I can imagine if you're turning units every 6 months, I mean, once you factor in, you know, a month down for make ready, assuming you got someone waiting in line to move back in, but then you got some cleanup costs. I mean, there's no money left. Maybe a couple bucks, but not really. I mean, it's, in fact, a drain on the resources, just having the manpower to turn those units on a regular basis, I can imagine. I'm curious to know, were those like one bedroom, one bath units that were kind of blended into like a more family all age park, or was this like a recreational area, or like who was the demographic that was moving in, or living in those one bedroom, one bath units?
Yeah. So it was not like a recreational area. It was just like they had some small lots that were really small. And instead of, you know, they just, instead of like bringing in actual RVs, they put these permanent, like, you know, park model, smaller RV type homes. yeah, they were just renting them out to anybody and everybody, and people just weren't staying. Like there was, you know, even people with kids that were living in these. And so, you know, if it was just like a single older person, you know, that may be all the space they need, but it wasn't like they just had an abundance of that type of, you know, demographic. It was a widespread that were living in these, and it's just, you're going to have higher turnover, and that's just going to be tougher to manage long term.
We actually had a community. I've only got one experience with a similar product like that and a similar problem. We bought a community in Oklahoma. It was literally half a mile down the street from Oklahoma State University. You know, one would think a great market. And there was about 7 1-bedroom, 1-bath units that had been put in by the prior ownership. When we took it over, there were 4 that were vacant, but like there were newer units. They were only probably 4 years old, 5 years old. So like newer vintage homes. And I just had, you know, chalked it up to, and, you know, it was a kind of a mom pop owner, you know, like they'd owned it for 20 years. Again, it didn't seem like they put much effort in trying to get them rented. But as we dove into the property and started, you know, uncovering the truths, one of the truths was that no one wanted to live in those units. We couldn't give those things away. And when I say give them away, you know, give them away for $450-$500 a month, I mean, could barely get them occupied then. And then even trying to sell them, I'm like, you know what, let's just see if we can get, because the lot rent in this park was like $400 a month, right? And so we'd be better off just giving them away for $500, you know, the entire unit. And even then, we did that on a couple of occasions, got quality, you know, folks that passed our background checks and our credit qualifications. Even then, they didn't stay living, like they would still turn like every, you know, 12 to 18 months, even though it was a resident-owned home, right? They'd just hand the title back to us and say, you know, Not a good fit for us. So yeah, it's definitely, I think it's a very niche boutique demographic that you're seeking with those tiny homes. I think it works really well here in Florida, you know, like the Sunbelt markets where you got folks that have second homes, you know, they got a home up north, they want to come down to snowbird, they've got a 1-bedroom, 1-bath and very much like a lifestyle community where there's pools and tennis courts and pickleball and all those things where they're kind of outdoors a lot of times. And really they're just sleeping, you know, in that unit because very difficult to, you know, live a normalized life in 400 square feet or whatever those units are. So, you know, there's one, I want to back it up a little bit because the first case study you gave was about property tax reassessments. And, you know, that's an interesting topic because there's a lot of deals that we look at where that becomes the difference of the deal making sense and not in a big way. And you know, it's unfortunate because like in some counties keep up with this, like they actually do reassessments every 1 or 3 years. Right. And so like, while there still might be a delta between what the assessment is today versus what it's going to be when you buy it, a lot of times it's not like 7x like you had just mentioned there, right? Like it might be still a big smack in the face and might, you know, have an impact on the economics of the deal. But a lot of times you might be able to finagle your way around it or find ways to make it work. But in this case, it sounds like it was a no-go. So I'm curious to know, like, because my conversation when you have a deal like that that's truly dying only because of the tax reassessment, the next buyer that comes to buy is going to have the same exact issue. And so curious to know how that conversation maybe went with the seller and had they not reconsidered that if they're going to sell, if they're sold on selling this thing, the next person in line is going to have the same exact problems, or maybe the next person in line is a bigger fool and they literally don't do the research and then they get smacked with a reassessment that just puts them underwater in short order. So just
that's the case with this scenario. There was another group looking at it and they were willing to put $100,000 down in hard money. They were putting $100,000 right behind us because while we were under contract, they cold called or approached this seller and said, "Hey, we're really hungry. We want this deal. We'll put $100,000 hard day one." I think he ended up signing with them and I don't know where it played out. But yeah, that's a major, major mishap if they did not check that, because that is going to throw your numbers off for years. But he's in my follow-ups to follow up and see, you know, if that did go through here in the next 60 days. And if it didn't, you know, I think he'll be more willing to, you know, negotiate with us.
I know that, Andrew, your property management team is vertically integrated. I think it's pretty much it's a requirement in the space. I know there's third-party management groups out there, but, you know, I think just no one's ever going to have your best interest in mind, right? No one's ever going to treat your own property like you do. And so, I guess what does your property management company look like today at a high level, like your staffing? And I think more specifically, given that, you know, property management doesn't have a lot of margins. I mean, it's definitely a thin margin business. And so I'd be curious to know, you know, any particular steps that you've taken over the years as you've kind of built out the property management company and evolved, What type of steps have you taken to lower costs and just build a more profitable property management arm?
So first off, our property management arm is not profitable. Like it takes, you know, acquisition fees and refi fees that we get from doing deals to pay for itself and keep it going. But that's only because I demand, you know, A players. And, you know, we about 3 years ago started, you know, bringing in regional managers that were experienced in the space and had been doing this a while, US based, that can travel to the communities and inspect them, you know, on a recurring basis. So that's been monumental for us because in the past, it was literally just myself and John Scortino, which I know you've met, my COO. And we were literally managing all of these parks ourselves, giving the direction, like every little thing. And then the people underneath of us would just execute. But we had to give the direction on every single thing. So can you tell I'm a control freak yet? But it's just, you know, there's just so many moving parts to managing these, and it's really, really important. But right now we have 46 employees in the corporate office, plus our on-site managers, which there's just under 50 of those, one at every park. So it's just it's a big operation now. There's more than just collecting rent and paying bills. There's HR, there's this whole, you know, realm of different, you know, things happening. And it also is amazing because now we have scale where we can say, hey, you three people are just going to focus on collections, right? That's your whole job is to, we have our own internal collections team. We have, you know, specific people in marketing, specific people in home sales. And it helps us be more, you know, specific in certain roles so that like our background check team, which we completely revamped, you know, just this last year, is much more robust. But yeah, it's a necessity, you know, Kevin, like to have good operations. You know, when I talk to people, I don't know about you, but you know, I'm a part of different masterminds, and I was at this mastermind, and there's this huge apartment operator there that has over a billion in assets under management. And a few years ago, he tells the story how he's like, you know what, mobile home parks, I get it. You know, it makes sense. Like, I'm going to get into the space. And he got in and bought 9 communities within 6 months. And then the second 6 months, he couldn't sell them fast enough because he was just like, this is way different than I thought it would be, like the operations and property management side of things. It's just, there's way more touch points than, you know, just asset managing a third party property management company. So it's just a different realm.
Yeah, no, agreed. Do you find that, you know, based on your team now, this new evolved infrastructure that you put in place, is there a certain target scale that once you get to this size, you'll feel like it'll at least be a break even?
That's a really good question. You know, we're at like just under 3,500 units. And I think as we always have been, we're growth minded. So we always are like 2 or 3 hires ahead of probably where we needed to be. But if we're like, hey, we're going to be at this number of lots forever, we probably could trim a little bit and, you know, make it break even. But you know, as we keep acquiring and buying new deals, it's always nice to have a couple extra than to be short.
No, agreed. It's always good to be proactive. In fact, I think that's the inherent mistake that a lot of entrepreneurs make, at least in the early stages of their businesses. They're always reactive with hiring, right? Like, because in the beginning days, I mean, you're barely maybe paying yourself, and you realize in order to actually bring someone else in to, you know, to help, you know, offload some of the burden, like you've got to take yourself 3 steps back financially in order to do that. And it's delayed gratification for a lot of time, many, many, many years. But it's worth it in the long run, especially once you've got a scalable team in place. Folks have got, you know, combined experience that exceeds your years in the business, right? Like that have seen a little bit of everything. They've worked with big growth organizations. Like there's so much value there, and being able to let go of the reins and know that, you know, they've got the wherewithal and they've got the knowledge to do it equally as good, if not maybe sometimes better than you would, right? And that's a beautiful thing. So let's maybe expand on that a little bit, that you kind of the talking point of growth. I'm sure, like, even today, I can say that from a personal perspective, like we're always breaking stuff internally and in the company, right? If you're not breaking it, you're not growing if you're not breaking anything. And so, you know, what are some of the areas maybe you can speak to outside of the property management? Were there any other areas that, you know, that you noticed maybe earlier on that you broke on a regular basis due to maybe lack of systems and processes, and maybe sharing some insights with the folks that are tuning in as they are maybe at the early stages of their business? Are there any of the areas that you could add value there with?
You know, it's easy to talk about these things now, but I was that guy back when it was just me and five, you know, employees, that we were always hiring late, right? So it's nice now that we have the scale to be able to have a few hires ahead. But yeah, I mean, I always tell this story about back in COVID, which was a few years ago. We were like, okay, we're going to go remote, you know, and our head bookkeeper, who does, like, she was bookkeeping and then also did some account payable stuff for us. She's like, okay, yeah, I'll just handle this from home, right? And it'll be fine. I'll just be able to, you know, get all the bookkeeping and stuff done. And literally she went home and like just stopped going to the PO box. And like, that's where all the utility bills and everything was coming in from the different parks. And so literally the way I found out was that the post office called me and was like, hey, your post office box is full. You need to come up here and check this out. I went and checked it out, and it was like a couple months worth of mail that just was like totally inefficient, right? Like, and at this time we had like checks and money orders coming in from certain tenants and not from other tenants. And so it was just a very inefficient process. And since moving to Paylease now, where everybody's online, or, you know, we don't accept checks and money orders, you know, we don't need a person just to open envelopes and deposit checks all day, where with that broken process, we did. So just multiple different things I can think of like that, where things have broken, and you know, it takes a week of working, you know, 100 hours a week to fix it. But then you learn and you move forward and keep trucking.
So as far as your mail, it's interesting because we have an old P.O. box from back in the day. We had an office like three offices ago near where that P.O. box was. And it's one of those things where we've just been delaying, you know, making the shift, because, you know, there's like so many addresses that are connected to that one PO box that it just becomes a burden. And so we've maintained that little tidbit of inefficiency in our business, because we haven't figured out a better way to get out of it. So curious to know, do you just have everything go to your corporate office now? You have a centralized corporate office, it sounds like.
You know, there are these, like, for some of our entities, like, that don't get a lot of mail, where they'll like, we'll put like the corporate services address on it, and they'll like scan everything and send it to you, you know. But for a park that could get, you know, 100 pieces of mail in a month, you know, because there's like all these entity documents and things, it just wasn't efficient. But
well, 95% of it's junk too, you know.
Junk. Yeah, you don't even need to see it. Exactly. So it's just it's frustrating. But yeah, it just goes to the corporate office, which is a little bit easier.
Yeah. No. Good deal. So. Well, awesome, buddy. It's always fun having you in the show, man. I always definitely walk away with a number of golden nuggets here. But maybe as we wrap it up here, we'd love to, you know, I think, you know, looking over the last couple of years, I'm sure that, you know, it sounds like you've had a number of great years over the last couple of years. We've done the same. We've been in growth mode. It's not like you have. And so I think we're the minority of the batch. I think a lot of other folks have maybe had some challenges, maybe not just in our industry, but just generally speaking in commercial real estate, there's more pain than there are, there's been more pain than profits. And so, you know, for folks that are maybe looking, LPs that are out there, a lot of LPs lost money as well with a variety of groups. You know, any tidbits of advice, for limited partners that are looking for an operator, you know, and determine whether or not that operator is the real deal. You know, it's just not smoke and mirrors with marketing, this, that, and the other. What are any questions that you would suggest that they be asking? I think it's funny because, like, you know, 5 years ago, there was more capital than there were deals. And, right, like, literally people were just throwing money at any operator, right? Whoever had the prettiest marketing was getting capital. Now, I think that a lot of those less than desirable or efficient operators have been kind of sorted out, right? But even then, a lot of limited partners they're not maybe overly sophisticated investors that know how to really determine like who truly is real and going to be, they're going to stand the test of time to those that are just a flash in the frying pan. So any words of wisdom that you could leave with them as they're out there seeking for their next opportunity?
Yeah, that's a really good question. You know, I think track record is going to be the number one repeated item, you know, is try to, you know, get proof of track record and then dig into that track record, right? Like, I had investors go drive through parks that we own before they would invest with us. to see what it looked like, right? And there was even this family office out of San Francisco that hired someone on Craigslist to go driving and send them a drive-through video of, you know, several of our parks before they would invest with us. So, you know, there's ways you can actually see kind of what's going on. And there's also been kind of cracks beneath the surface on some other operators because the operations kind of fell apart. And I think, you know, when you're working with someone and you need to, you know, sign documentation and you need to go back and forth, you know, you'll kind of get a gut feeling. Is this an organized operation? Does it feel like things are, you know, moving the right direction? Or is it kind of, is there any red flags that come up in that kind of courting process in the beginning? And I would just be very aware but I think at this stage, like investing with someone in their first deal, you know, is that's how we got started. Somebody had to take a chance on us. But I just think that, you know, even when we were doing our first mobile home park deal, you probably could look back and say, hey, well, they flipped houses. You know, we had a track record. It just might not have been in the mobile home park space. Right. But I think, if they've shown project management experience and those type of things, it would be really helpful. But I think one other thing is look at the debt they're going to put on these things. I think that's kind of got overlooked a lot, right? A few years ago when people got in trouble is hey, how levered up are they going to do, you know, this deal? And I went to this Reconvene conference out in California, and the guys that Charlie Munger invested with to buy apartments, you know, all over California, you know, one thing they said is like the only way Charlie would do this is if we locked in 15-year debt from day one, right? He's like, he always had this really long view of things. And it was like, I'm not going to do this 5-year kind of, you know, fix and flip thing. It's like, no, if we're going to do this, we're going to put as long a debt as we can put on this thing at, you know, 3%, right? When they got started, and we're going to use that to our advantage. So I think just having that awareness to know, hey, this is the plan here. It's a long, you know, long-term hold type of investment. And this is the debt they're putting on it. It matches what they're saying. And then also, you know, looking at the other guy that's saying, hey, we're going to have a bridge loan. We're going to have a primary loan. We're going to have, you know, a loan for improvements, and we're going to be, you know, over leveraged. That's where I think a lot of people got in trouble. So I would just try to just not do that.
You know, we're at the point now where we're starting to relook at maybe 10-year debt on certain deals, but we're still, for the most part, only putting 5-year debt, but 5-year fixed, you know, no balloons or anything like that leading up to the fact, or no adjustment periods, but 5-year fixed term debt with the idea that I do believe that rates are going to continually come down, at least for a period of time. And so we're not willing to really lock in 10 years yet, unless it's just a really compelling reason to do so. I'm curious to know as to what you guys are looking at and you know, through what lens, and what are your considerations with debt today?
Yeah, I mean, on new acquisitions, we're using kind of like regional banks, credit unions for 5-year fixed rate at a minimum. And then what we'll tell them is, hey, we really want this to be a 10-year balloon, but can you just fix it for 5 and then just have it reset at year 5 just in case, you know, that year 5 happens to be 2008. So we do that on our new acquisitions, and then we refi into agency debt, 10-year debt. So we still think that 6% rates are pretty good. And we're just, if the deal's cash flowing, you know, at that point, because we're not refining into like 80% leverage. It's typically, you know, 60-70%. So we're just still refining and then putting that really long debt on it and just kind of holding on. But I would be nice to have those interest rates, you know, from a few years ago.
Well, Andrew, my friend, this has been a pleasure. Always incredible value that you bring to the equation. So I appreciate you taking the time out of your busy golf schedule and joining us here today. It's always good catching up, bud. For those that want to learn more, you know, where's the best place to track you down? I mean, a website, any social pages that you spend time on?
Yeah, website would be best. It's just keelteam.com. It's down at the bottom of the screen if you're watching the video. And yeah, got a YouTube channel and stuff like that too. But yeah, we have a free ebook on keelteam.com that talks about the top 20 things I've learned from investing in mobile home parks, and it's free. You can download it and check it out.
Awesome, buddy. Well, appreciate you, and to everyone as well that tuned in here today. You know, if you did enjoy today's episode, please do take a moment, you know, subscribe to the show, leave a rating and review. It really does help us continue to grow the podcast and attract, you know, awesome guests like Andrew to the show. And with that, till we see you again on next week's show, wishing each and every one of you strong deals and even a stronger cash flow. Take care now.